Welcome to a University of Bath IPR Policy Podcast.
Welcome to this Institute for Policy Research event. My name is Nick Pearce. I'm the director of the Institute. I'm very pleased today to be able to welcome you to the launch of a new report, Coping and Hoping, Navigating the Ups and Downs of Monthly Assessment in Universal Credit. This is a report that's based on research that's been undertaken at the Institute by my colleagues, Dr. Rita Griffiths and Dr. Marsha Wood. They will present the findings of the research to you today, and then there'll be an opportunity for some discussion and some debate, of course, and please do ask questions in the chat after the presentation is concluded, and we can then put those to Marsha and Rita, discuss the implications of the research. It's an in-depth exploration of working claimants' experiences of monthly assessment in Universal Credit. Universal Credit, the new system that brings together a number of previous benefits and moves towards a system of monthly assessment of claimants' incomes. And this is a group, working claimants, about which we know very little. Some 39% of Universal Credit claimants are in work or living with a partner in paid work. And so understanding how the system works for them in real life settings is very important. Before I introduce Rita and Marsha, I just want to say a word of thanks, firstly, to the 42 participants who took part in the research. This is based on qualitative research with 42 participants. Also to Maria Jose Ventura Alfaro, who helped us with the interviews. Very grateful to her for her work. To an advisory group of distinguished experts, officials and others who gave their support to the research throughout. And finally, to the Aberdeen Financial Fairness Trust for funding the project. Very important that we're funded to do this work. So thank you very much to Aberdeen Financial Fairness Trust, and particularly to Karen Barker for her support throughout the research too. I'll hand over now to Rita and Marsha. They will present their main findings. And as I said, there'll be the opportunity for discussion and debate in the final part of the lunchtime session we have today. We've got about an hour, so plenty of time to listen to the research and to discuss and debate it. And there will be links to the executive summary, the report, the policy brief and other things available that will be posted in the Zoom chat later. So you can catch up with everything after we've finished today's report event. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Dr. Rita Griffiths. Rita.
Thank you, Nick. And thanks everybody for joining. So today I'm going to start with a description of our project, a little bit of background around the policy of monthly assessment in Universal Credit, what it's meant to do, and then our research questions, the methods that we used and our sample of participants. And then moving on to findings, Marsha is going to talk about income volatility and household income in relation to the minimum income standard. Then I'll talk again about effects on household finances and budgeting, and explore some of the policy implications arising out of the research for taking questions from you. So thanks again to Aberdeen Financial Fairness Trust that funded our research. So this is a qualitative research project, although we were collecting quantitative data as well. And we were exploring how the system of monthly assessment in Universal Credit, which is used to assess entitlement, in some cases to recover debts, and to calculate the monthly payment, how this affects income security and financial well-being. And our focus was very much on working households. As Nick said, we know very little about working households, and that includes people in work and also in self-employment. And the focus is very much on the monthly means test as well and how that impacts. And what we did was to track month-to-month changes in income, household income, in real time over a 13-month period between February 2022 and March 2023. So what are these key design features of monthly assessment? So Universal Credit is a benefit that is assessed and paid monthly in arrears, intended to be like paying a salary, which means that any earnings or other income that are captured within a claimant's assessment period, which is a calendar month, these are used to calculate entitlement. And there is a monthly means test, which also includes any entitlement for childcare costs, which means that entitlement is reduced by 55 pence against net monthly earnings after any work allowance. So some people are entitled to earn a certain amount of money before this taper is applied. But sometimes other benefits are withdrawn pound for pound. So for example, a carer's allowance. And for claimants who are paid on PAYE, this process happens automatically, meant to be in real time in response to changes in the previous month's earnings and income. Earnings as reported by their employer to HMRC's real-time information system. There are quite complex rules for self-employed people, which I won't go into in detail here, but we might talk about them later. And there's also self-reporting for self-employed people and people below the PAYE thresholds every month. They have to self-report their earnings. Entitlement can be reduced by policies such as the two-child limit, bedroom tax, some people may be familiar with, and also deductions for advanced loans, for benefit overpayments if people have them, and also third-party debts for rent arrears, council tax, and so on. A complex algorithm calculates for people what the monthly payment will be. And this contrasts quite significantly to the previous system of working tax credit, which was paid for weekly or weekly at the same rate for a year. And it was based on a self-completed annual return using the previous year's income. So what is monthly assessment meant to do? So this automatic rise and fall in the universal credit monthly payment is intended to reduce overpayments, which was an issue with the previous tax credit system. Also to reduce fraud and error, that people not notifying changes of circumstances in time, and also intended to smooth these peaks and troughs in income that happen if earnings go up or down, to stabilise and to help supplement incomes. Ideally to help with budgeting as well, monthly budgeting, and also the intention is to incentivise work and higher earnings, as people can see the difference that different amounts of earnings can make on the universal credit monthly payment. The expectation being here that claimants should save or set aside some of their earnings in the periods to cover when their wages might reduce or they find themselves out of work. But in fact, little is actually known about how these design features actually play out in real life. So that's what our research was intended to look at. So research questions, we looked at how universal credit plays out in real time, in real life settings, how volatile monthly incomes are, whether the adjustment to the payment was smooth, what whether people were able to generate a savings buffer, and the kind of budgeting and coping strategies they use to manage their incomes if they fluctuated. And then does monthly assessment actually impact on work incentives? Do people work longer hours earn higher amounts? So the methods we used, we recruited our sample from a previous ESRC study, which included working claimants. And we also recruited new using a recruitment agency, using social media. So we collected both qualitative and quantitative data. The universal credit statement was key because this contains earnings and income data every month, and also entitlements, any deductions. So we gathered monthly statements for all our participants and then conducted a monthly or a two-monthly interview to verify this and just to find out what had actually happened, how they were managing their budgets. And we collected data for 13 months between February 22 and March 2023. For 37 of our 42 participants, we collected enough data, so 9 months plus, to be able to put together really quite detailed month-to-month income charts. And we conducted overall 256 interviews, telephone and face-to-face. All the interviews were recorded and transcribed, and we used a software package called MaxQDA. Quantitative data analysed using Excel and SPSS. So our characteristics of our sample, we had 61 claimants in 42 households in which there were one or two earners or self-employment at the start of the research. Obviously, there was some churning there. People moved in and out of jobs, left work for reasons of ill health and so on. What we had one interviewee per household. We had 36 women and 6 men across England, Scotland and Wales. Our oldest participant was 58 and our youngest 21. It was a mainly white British sample, which reflected the areas that we went to. We had a very good cross-section of claimants. So we had 19 couples, 17 lone parents and 6 single claimants, and also 33 families with dependent children. And of the 50 claimants who were working, we had a good range of pay rates. So although they were at the lower end of the spectrum, £9.50 per hour being the minimum wage that applied at the time the research started, but up to as much as £27 an hour for one participant. And in terms of pay frequency, half of our participants were paid monthly and half non-monthly. So our headline findings, we found that quite a large majority of our households experienced significant volatility in their incomes month to month, and that it was changes in earnings that was actually driving this change in monthly income, but particularly the interaction between changes in earnings and changes in the monthly universal credit payment, which was actually at the core of this volatility. We also found that rather than smoothing and stabilising incomes, monthly assessment could often accentuate rather than dampen income volatility. And that because a lot of our households had very low household income, many people struggled to manage that volatility. They were unable to save and set aside income when their universal credit dropped. Therefore, a lot were forced to borrow, fueling debt in some cases. We also found that the monthly means test and the way in which universal credit and other entitlements for means tested benefits are withdrawn as earnings rise, that they appeared to have weakened in our sample rather than strengthened work incentives. So let's unpick those findings a little bit. So I'm going to pass over to Marcia, who's going to talk about household incomes.
Thanks, Rita. I'm just going to talk briefly about some of the main quantitative findings from our research. So obviously, as Rita said, one of the main things we're interested was how stable or volatile household incomes were. And we decided we'd look at this by using a way of categorising household income volatility or stability that was developed by John Hills and colleagues in 2006 on their study of tax credits. We adapted this slightly for our own research. And we found, as Rita's already said, that monthly household incomes were highly volatile for those in our sample. So 26 out of the 37 households had monthly incomes that were highly erratic or falling or erratic. And only 11 of the 37 households had monthly incomes that were broadly stable or rising. So these charts here just show this in a bit more detail. So you can see in the chart on the left that most were in the highly erratic group. And actually, we didn't have any in our sample that were highly stable or stable. And as Rita's mentioned, variable earnings were the principal driver of monthly changes in income. So we looked at the different elements of the household's income. And we found that earnings which changed month to month were surprisingly common and unexpectedly large. So for 22 of the 37 households, earnings varied month to month by an average of £200 or more. For 16 of the 37 households, they varied by an average of £300 or more. For 28 of the 37 households, earnings varied by £500 or more from one month to the next, at least once in the year. And for 16 of the 37 households, they varied by £1,000 or more from one month to the next, at least once. And we looked at the other sort of elements of income as well, and we found that the government's cost of living payments, they didn't have a great effect on changing these kind of levels, income levels, overall income volatility levels. Other benefits such as child benefit, PIP or DLA, they did have a small stabilising effect on incomes. And again, as we just mentioned, so the monthly changes in earnings had an impact in driving the changes in the universal credit payments. So the monthly fluctuations in universal credit were very frequent and sometimes very large. So for 23 of the 37 households, the payments varied, the universal credit payments varied month to month by an average of £100 or more. And for 8 of the 37 households, they varied month to month by an average of £200 or more. And actually for over half of the households, the payments varied by £400 or more at least once during the year. And for 10 of the households, they varied by £600 or more at least once during the year. So a lot of change there. And so we were also interested to put these kind of levels of volatility of income in the context of overall levels of income, so how much money people actually received. So we looked at the different households' levels of income over the year and compared these to the minimum income standard that those different household types should be expected to receive. So the minimum income standard is a measure developed by Loughborough University that looks at the amount of money that different household types should need to have an acceptable, socially acceptable standard of living. And we can see from this chart here that we had only 5 that kind of were above the minimum income standard, and most were falling quite far below the minimum income standard for their household type. And in fact, those that were above the minimum income standard, there's a bit of a caveat there because the minimum income standard measure doesn't include costs for disability, whereas those were included in our data. So they may actually be below the minimum income standard. So in terms of the minimum income standard, comparing to this data, so the average monthly income standard, so we had the average monthly income after housing childcare costs was below the minimum income standard for all but 5 households. And among the rest of the households, 11 had an average monthly income that was 0-19% below the minimum income standard. 16 had average monthly incomes that were 20-39% below. And 4 had average monthly incomes that were 40-59% below the minimum income standard. And 1 was falling very far below the minimum income standard. So overall, 32 of the 37 households had average incomes that were below the minimum income standard, despite 32 having at least one earner throughout the study and 35 having at least one earner for 8 months or more of the study. So I'm going to hand back to Rita now to carry on with the...
Thank you. So this begs the question about why monthly earnings are so volatile. And we found that earnings varied both due to actual and reported changes in earnings. So actual changes in earnings being where monthly pay increases or decreases. And this is due to changes in working hours, shift patterns, periods of unemployment, unpaid sick leave, which was very common in our sample. And these are kind of expected findings. It's mainly affecting below paid, people in temporary jobs, agency staff, people on 0-hour contracts and self-employed people. Much more unexpected was the extent of variability in earnings that we found among those who were, you know, relatively high paid, people who were working full time as well, and those who were monthly salaried in on the face of it, much more secure employment. 32 of 50 working participants actually said that or described their job as being permanent. And what we found is that in these cases, often the monthly earnings increase significantly due to unconsolidated pay awards, so one-off increases in pay for performance or backdated pay increases, which could actually increase when added to regular monthly earnings, could increase the earnings amount, sometimes by thousands of pounds within the month, which would cause universal credit to plunge or often to be nil the following month, causing lots of budgeting difficulties for people. And in many cases, these effects went either unaware by employers, or they were simply unable to change their payroll systems to accommodate their universal credit claimants within their employees. We also found reported changes in earnings to be a key factor. So this is where earnings are just captured by the RTI HMRC system. where underlying earnings actually stay unchanged. And it's been known about for a long time that pay frequency is a key factor here. So for people who aren't paid monthly, more multiple pay packets can be captured within a single assessment period. And also for monthly paid, if the start or end of their assessment period is close to when they are paid, or if they're paid early due to a bank holiday, for example, then that can also capture 2 months' pay in a single month, causing the universal credit to plunge the following month. But we also found that employer-related reasons were really important too. So just errors in payroll systems and in tax codes, and also just late submissions by employers, which to HMRC's system, which meant that earnings could be under or over-reported. And these incorrect earnings that weren't actually received by participants were actually then driving the fluctuations in the universal credit payment, which would be addressed at some stage, but could cause serious income fluctuations in the meantime. So in this context, universal credit is meant to smooth out these changes in income. We actually found that when universal credit increased, when earnings dropped, was a really useful income top-up and a real safety net for people if they're off sick without pay, or when hours were reduced at short notice. But when UC reduces due to earnings increasing or being recorded as increasing, that caused major problems for people. And it wasn't just the loss of the universal credit, but that the amount of the reduction was often really very large and quite hard to predict. So people weren't able to compensate for that. And also it's difficult to verify as well, because people are only notified 7 days before they receive their universal credit how much they're going to get. 3/4 of our sample had no savings. So losing their entitlement was a major issue for them. We also found there could be a time lag of up to 2 months rather than just a month, because wages are paid in arrears and universal credit is paid in arrears. Sometimes this meant that people received both high wages and a high universal credit payment 1 month, and then no wages and no universal credit another month, again causing budgeting difficulties and financial problems. Also, nil awards and higher earnings could actually impact on other means tested entitlement, including cost of living payments and help with council tax. And of course, people on the lowest income struggled the most. And in many cases, this was fueling borrowing from family and friends if they had them, but also overdrafts, credit cards. And then this in turn reduced the ability to save and set aside funds in subsequent months. So in this way, monthly assessment could actually exacerbate income volatility. And then why was household income generally so low? These are people who are households who are working, somebody in work, and also they're getting benefits as well. Lots of people working part-time, not exclusively, but also obviously low hourly rates of pay to allow them to be entitled to universal credit in most cases. But a key issue was just having to bridge the gap between the amount of support entitlement people got towards their housing costs and how much they actually had to pay for their private rent. So the local housing allowance in most places is actually much lower than private rents. There's also virtually no help for people who have mortgages. There is a mortgage loan scheme, but none of our participants took advantage of that. And also help with council tax only available for people on the very lowest earnings. In addition to that, there were deductions for overpayments, reductions in entitlement due to the two child limit. We had a number of families in our sample with three or more children, and also with adult children living at home, so further deductions for that. Also, again, universal credit help with childcare costs is tapered away with earnings as part of the monthly means test, leaving people with paid childcare with gaps to make up. And then self-employed claimants have something called the minimum income floor after 12 months of trading, which can significantly overestimate their earnings. We also found errors and underpayments on the part of universal credit. So where people were missing elements to which they were entitled, or had had their universal credit payment reduced incorrectly. So for example, we had a family who had had the entitlement capped by the two child limit, but it was a case of a multiple birth, which was an exception. I think Martha's intervention was able to help with that situation. And we also had a number of cases where people were getting carers allowance for an adult or a disabled child, but they weren't getting carers element within universal credit or the disabled child element. And often earners were ineligible for budgeting loans because they earned too much. They were often ineligible for the Help to Save scheme because they earned too little, and discretionary help such as the Household Support Fund or discretionary housing payments, again, and social tariffs, very few people with earnings were able to get this extra financial help. So in this context, most people in our sample struggled to save and set aside a portion of their income in the months that they earned or earned more, which is what the policy assumes and requires in order to smooth out some of these fluctuations. It wasn't about irresponsible spending or poor budgeting skills. Virtually everybody in our sample prioritised paying rent and important bills if they were able to. As we've mentioned, people may not actually be earning any more money, but it's just that the way in which their earnings are captured by HMRC's system or how earnings are reported by employers, that it appears as though they're actually earning more when they're not. If they did actually earn more, then higher earnings or a nil universal credit payment could actually mean the loss of entitlement, not only to work allowances if people got them, but also to other means tested help. So for example, council tax reduction, preschool meals, prescription charges, and cost of living payments. And in Scotland, the Scottish Child Payment as well. So a nil universal credit payment meant people lost entitlement to that. And that's £25 every week for every child aged 16 and under. So quite significant drops in income overall. Extra hours work can also incur additional costs, so transport costs, additional childcare costs. And we found that in many cases, if people did work overtime and earn more, often it was to pay for specifically for household items that they needed, so school uniforms, to replace the washing machine, or to help move house. And of course, then the money was spent and was not available then to cover a drop in the universal credit payment in subsequent months. Also, income in the current month could have decreased. For example, child maintenance payments that just didn't arrive or were less than people were expecting. And then often people had debts outside of universal credit as well. So repaying family, repaying credit cards or overdrafts, IVAs, and several participants had student loans as well, which they were repaying. Two-thirds of participants said that they actually ran out of money before the end of the month. This was in spite of at least one person in the household working throughout most of the research. So in terms of work incentives, we also found that earning more didn't necessarily make people better off. So adjusting the universal credit payment monthly and having a single taper rather than multiple tapers, as was the case under the previous system, is intended to make the financial gains from working more apparent, so they're more visible, they're more immediate, and this is meant to make it more rewarding, that people can see the difference that that working more actually makes. And in this research, and in our previous research and in other research too, we actually find the opposite is the case, that when people actually see their payments, universal credit payments reducing, it can often discourage rather than incentivize longer hours of work. The cliff edges, so other entitlement to other means tested benefits means that even earning just a few more pounds extra can actually mean that people lose entitlement to council tax support, for example, or prescription charges. So the amount that they earned more was actually less than they lost in terms of their Their entitlement to means tested help that they would have otherwise been entitled to. And actually some were made worse off by that. Marginal effective tax rates, sometimes in excess of 75-80%. In many cases. It particularly affected second earners and couples with children and single claimants because they had no work allowance, and so the 55% table was applied from the first pound of earnings. And these could act as barriers to higher earnings. Sometimes people were declining offers of overtime once they had understood the effects of universal credit, how extra earnings could impact. And then people whose work conditionality allowed them to reduce hours did so in order to minimise the adverse financial effects on household income. So how do we reduce income volatility and increase income security for universal credit claimants who are working? So alongside operating benefits, there have been lots calling for an increase in standard allowances, and our research would support that benefit rates have not kept up with inflation for more than a decade. But specifically in relation to working claimants, allowing them to keep more of their earnings would be a good place to start. So reducing the taper from 55 pence in the pound, and then potentially extending eligibility for work allowances. So for example, to second earners in couples or single claimants who were in fact included as being eligible for work allowance when universal credit was first rolled out, but then that was subsequently withdrawn. And then an increase in the work allowance, so the amount that people are allowed to earn before the taper is applied. So, I mean, all these have huge cost implications, but the relative costs and benefits would need to be looked at closely. But obviously, if people are earning and paying more tax, then a lot of those additional costs could be offset by higher more people in work, you know, particularly more working mothers in couples. Reforms to monthly assessment is clearly needed. So allowing claimants to change their assessment period. Assessment periods are fixed when people make a claim for universal credit. It's fixed from the date they make their claim. A lot of people are unaware of the significance of that when they make the claim. It's particularly relevant for managed migration, so people who are moving over from tax credit. So simply being made aware of the significance of that is really important. DWP have always insisted that that can't be changed, the assessment period, but there's nothing to stop it being changed other than just policy saying that it can't be. And also allowing people to change it who move jobs or whose dates align really badly with when they get paid. And then potentially averaging out earnings as well, particularly for people who are paid four weekly, but also potentially weekly and two weekly, so that their payments don't fluctuate in the same way. And then fixing payments potentially over a longer period of 3 or 6 months. Obviously, there would need to be an adjustment further down the line, so that would need to be looked at. Another key area is the interaction with other means-tested benefits. So there is a need to remove the cliff edges, so just earning a few extra pounds can lose entitlement, but also to standardise earnings thresholds, which are different both between different types of means-tested help and within local authorities. So, for example, each local authority has its own council tax reduction scheme in which earnings thresholds and treatment of working claimants are very different. So that needs to be looked at. And as others have called for further reductions in deductions for debt and writing off historical social fund loans, some of which in our sample were going back more than 10 years, in one case, I think 20 years. And also overpayments for tax credits that are historical over 10 years. Notwithstanding the changes to the childcare offer that have recently been made, there are reforms needed to the childcare element of universal credit as regards means testing and payment in arrears to people. Further work needed there. And then looking at entitlement for budgeting loans and help to save schemes to make them more accessible for working claimants. Bringing employers into the conversation, really important. Their role is key for working claimants. They've not been to date been involved much in universal credit, but the way in which they remunerate people, their pay policies, and also the way in which they submit earnings data to HMRC have huge implications for employees who receive universal credit. So more work is needed to engage them. And then finally, just using the automated potential of universal credit to the benefit of claimants and not just the DWP. So it works incredibly well, automated ways to reclaim overpayments. But for people who are underpaid, there is no similarly automated process. People have to recognise they've been underpaid and then contact the DWP to claim any underpayment. Better data sharing with other parts of the DWP would completely remove that, or certainly minimise the amount of under and overpayments that happen. So as mentioned earlier, we've got a number of written outputs. Hopefully the links will be in the chat and available online, if not now, then later today. We did have some technical issues earlier, but we think we resolved them. So we have a main report for people that would like to look at that, the findings in detail. We have an executive summary, which is more research oriented, a policy brief, looking more at the policy implications, and there is also an IPR blog. As I mentioned, there are certain areas that need further work. So the relationship between universal credit and entitlement for other means tested support, self-employment and universal credit, and also universal credit and childcare costs. And we will be putting together three additional policy briefs specifically addressing those three key policy areas between May and October. Thank you for listening, and sorry if I rattled through those slides very quickly. Right, so we can now move on to questions, hopefully. Thank you so much for listening.
Great, thank you very much, Rita, and thank you, Marcia. Really comprehensive presentation of the research and its findings, and a lot to think about. So we would very much welcome people's questions and discussion. We have a couple here that have come in from Peter Matejic. Perhaps Rita, Marcia, you could address these to get us started. Firstly, the sample size, samples being skewed towards female participants, was that a deliberate decision? And the second question, can you say anything more about the frequency of universal credit increasing rather than decreasing, dampening income volatility as it's intended to? The question then goes on to say, I realise the study is qualitative, but it'd be great to get a sense of that too. So increases rather than decreases, what's the frequency of those? So a couple of questions there, perhaps if you could address those first and we'll see if any further ones come in.
Sure. So yes, females in our sample. I think we find across the piece that it's women that tend to take part in research. Largely, I suppose that's because it's women often that are managing household budgets more than male claimants. So in our previous research looking at couples, we found that predominantly it was women who were managing household budgets. They're much more on top of income and outgoings. They're managing household income month to month. So they're more on top of what's actually happening. I think, as I say, it's just a feature of qualitative research that more women tend to agree to take part. And also, there are lots of women who are in receipt of universal credit. So lone parents, obviously, predominantly are women. And I think they are the key reasons why. I mean, we didn't deliberately set out to recruit only women. It just tends to be the women that are responding, I think. Marcia, I mean, would you generally agree with that?
No, I would agree, and definitely because we want to include quite a few of them with children, so lone parents as well. They tend to more likely be women.
I think
with the couple study, I was gonna say with the couple study, that is a good way to include, get men included, isn't it, when you interview both partners, but we weren't doing that in this study.
Our previous research did interview both partners in a couple, both men and women. We did obviously include information about where it was the male partner who was earning, then it was the female partner who was providing that information for us. That's the other practical reason, is that they were out at work, so just not generally available to do month-to-month interviews. So it was quite a time commitment for people. Women in our sample more likely to be at home caring for children, so just more time available to actually take part in the research, as I say, which was quite a commitment to people to do it month-to-month. And then the second question, which was about the frequency of universal credit increasing. I don't have a figure to hand for that. I mean, Marcia, can you think of anything?
I'm not quite sure.
Adjustment to the universal credit, as I understand the question, credit payment when earnings dropped, so increasing. So unpaid leave, for example, years of unemployment. So how frequent was that compared with a drop in the universal credit payment when earnings increased? My feel is that it was the latter that was more frequent. I mean, not that you can necessarily read anything into that, because it's qualitative research, but.
Yeah. And I think when we were looking at the data, we were focused more on looking at the overall kind of volatility, weren't we, over the year, and that impacts on people. And obviously there's the time lag issue with everything being out of sync, so that was kind of more of our focus. It might be something we could look at.
I mean, it's an interesting question, but we just don't have the data at our fingertips.
Okay, thanks very much. We have a question from Hannah from CPAG about employers, and I think one of the interesting things about this research is the analysis of the role of employers and the infrastructure of employers for delivering universal credit for people in work, and the reliance on that infrastructure. Hannah asks, were there issues with employers inputting pay information incorrectly? How was this resolved? If they did it incorrectly, did the UC claimant have to actively address it, or did it sort itself out automatically? What's the sort of process?
We do cover this in quite some detail in the report, so I would urge Hannah and others to read those sections. It was incredibly onerous. It was nearly always down to the individual to address these issues, to identify them and to address them, because in most cases, employees wouldn't necessarily know that they're getting universal credit. Maybe some people wouldn't want their employer to know, but it's certainly not routinely known by employers. And so people were having to advocate on their own behalf and challenge errors at both ends, both with the employer and also at the DWP end as well. So having to provide evidence of how much they'd actually been paid, so providing bank statements, and also, going back to employers as well. And some of it was quite tricky. So situations where it particularly affected smaller businesses, but not exclusively. Sometimes payroll services are contracted out to specialist organisations, so that was an issue. But also in smaller businesses, payroll staff, often they're part-time, they might come in once a month to do the books, so more of a kind of bookkeeper. And in a number of cases, we had staff who were off sick were just not working as they should have been. And so they're kind of quite tricky to negotiate with people. I mean, in one case, we had payroll staff who were quite seriously ill. And so the person who'd had quite serious problems with, like, her earnings being reported incorrectly felt unable to kind of raise the problem, because this person was quite seriously ill and she didn't want to get her into trouble. Those kind of personal issues that can arise, but in the main, it was nearly all having to be resolved by individuals. And of course, that massively increase the sort of burden on people who are in work and trying to manage their money, on top of which, you know, they're having to kind of challenge these challenge the DWP and correct these errors. And it's, I think in one case, Marcia, it actually went on month after month for about 6 months before it was resolved. So really quite problematic for some individuals.
Yeah, I think definitely. I think Maria, the other person in the team, I think was definitely speaking to someone, and that happened for quite a long time.
Yeah, so another case that I can recall is an employer submitting, you know, 3 months worth of earnings in one go because they just were late submitting the data to HMRC, and this couple actually lost entitlement to Universal Credit for, you know, for a long time, and had to reapply for it. So, you know, again, simply raising awareness of these issues, but obviously getting employers to engage more actively. We did have positive examples, actually, quite rare, but in a couple of cases, employers going to pay a bonus within a month, and one of their employees who was getting Universal Credit approached the employer and asked if the bonus could be spread over a longer period of time to reduce the impact on the Universal Credit payment. And they basically extended it to all of their employees and said anybody who would like the bonus to be spread over a longer period, we're more than happy to do that. So it can, you know, it can have sort of positive effects when employers are notified of these kind of effects.
Yes, and presumably in the research period, there was a greater use of one-off payments and awards bonuses by employers because of the spike.
Yes, that's actually happening much more. I mean, it's happening in the NHS. People are getting these kind of lump sum pay awards rather than, you know, if the same amount was spread over a 12-month period, the impacts would be significantly lessened in terms of entitlement for Universal Credit. But these large lump sums, sometimes they're sort of unconsolidated. So it's just, it's a pay award, but obviously the pay then doesn't subsequently increase. It's just a one-off. It can have, you know, huge implications for entitlement for Universal Credit, and that's a trend I think that's quite recent. So sometimes, you know, cost of living payments as well that employers have made, thinking that they're actually trying helping people and not realizing the impact on Universal Credit.
Okay, we've got quite a number of questions that have come in, and about, you know, 10 and a bit minutes left. So firstly, from Fran Bennett, I know you focus on earnings changes rather than on changes of circumstances, but did you get any impression about whether changes in circumstances would be worth investigating, as they're treated as having changed for the whole assessment period rather than pro rata? So that's one from Fran. And then related from Ruth Lister, was there an issue around monthly payment for those not paid monthly, and do you think there's a case for rethinking monthly assessment altogether? Let's take those two, and then we'll come to the question of sort of policy recommendations, which Karen and Greg Ashton raise.
So changes of circumstance. Yes, I didn't address that just through lack of time, Fran, but yes, it's covered in the report. So in addition to earnings, of course, there are changes of circumstance from one month to the next for some people. So moving in and out of relationships, new children moving in and out of households, new babies, which all adds to complexity around the Universal Credit payment and how it's calculated. But also, as you said, whole month approach to calculation as well. So particularly affecting people as regards their rent payments. So sometimes it worked in their favour. Depending on when they moved out and into their new property, sometimes it massively worked against them financially. It's quite a technical issue which we haven't got time to go into. But yes, it was an issue for some people, and it's addressed in more detail in the report.
Okay, and monthly assessment?
Monthly assessment, yeah. I think in the policy implications and suggestions, we do say monthly assessment does need to be reconsidered. Obviously, the whole architecture of the Universal Credit system has been built around monthly assessment. So there are huge kind of technical issues around changing that. They're not insurmountable. They're still, you know, these are policy choices that need to be made. But there are ways in which earnings could, for people who are not paid monthly, could be averaged out over the months potentially, which wouldn't necessarily mean changing the entire basis on which the architecture has been built. I mean, as I say, they're quite technical questions, but I do think monthly assessment needs to be relooked at, particularly in relation to how it affects work incentives as well. The fact that these changes don't seem to be performing, affecting behaviour in the sort of positive ways that the policy assumes as regards earning more.
I mean, that's actually the subject of the final question from Ian at JRF, that, you know, that you see people not wanting to earn more or to do extra overtime, etc., because even though they would be better off overall, that they fear the loss of universal credit and would prefer predictable, stable income. Ian asks, you know, can you expand on that a little bit more, please? Perhaps you could deal with that, Marshall Reed, and then we'll spend the last 10 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, important to say that overall they wouldn't necessarily be better off. As I said, it would depend on whether they were getting other means-tested benefits. So loss of council tax support can be a huge amount of money for people. Prescription charges, again, very expensive if they lose entitlement for that. Cost of living payments, worth £650 overall. So, you know, these big amounts of money, it's not just the loss of entitlement to universal credit. So a small increase in earnings can mean a big loss of entitlement to other means-tested benefits. And so it was a question about, you know, whether people prefer stability. And I think in most cases, they would. We did ask that question of people, the extent to which stability matters. And some said, I would even accept a slightly lower payment if I knew that I was getting the same amount every month. So incentives work in more complex ways than the policy assumes. It's not just a kind of straightforward kind of extra bit of money, you know, motivates people to do X, Y. It's more complex than that.
Yeah. And there's I do want to come back to the questions about recommendations, but both Mike Brewer and Hannah at CPAC have asked this question about overpayments. Obviously, when in the previous tax credit system, you know, because you're assessed on a year, you might then have a huge overpayment to repay. And that was one of the kind of central reasons for moving to monthly credit. And as Mike says, you know, this got enormous under tax credit. So the sort of policy question here is, you know, is there some way of going from the volatility of monthly assessment and the sort of uncertainty about levels of award, and without going back to the problem of annual assessment, yearly assessment, generating very high levels of overpayment?
Well, yes. I mean, you could look at 3 months or 6 months, for example. So, and this has been suggested. I think some work that Jane Miller and Fran Bennett did, actually, for House of Lords Economics Committee might have suggested it, is fixing payments for longer periods to give people more stability. I mean, obviously, there is an adjustment that's going to be needed at some point. So there are always going to be trade-offs. I mean, on the overpayment of the tax credits, I mean, obviously, anybody notifying of a change of circumstances would have their payment adjusted soon after the notification. I guess that not everybody did that, hence why there were a lot of problems with overpayments. And I think some of those issues were resolved subsequently, or at least reduced. So, as I say, there's a balance to be struck, really, between, you know, monthly assessment on the one hand and annual on the other. Yes, let's look at some kind of periods, perhaps 3 months, which I think some systems, some European systems have periods, longer periods. And actually some council tax reduction schemes, as I understand it, fixed their support for a 6 month period. These schemes change all the time, so I'm not particularly well up on the current ones, but certainly when I looked at it a few years ago, some of them fixed their support for a 6 month period, regardless of whether earnings went up or down. So there's nothing to, you know, to stop that happening within universal credit. It's a policy choice.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's end then with the sort of the question that Karen raises about, and it's a difficult one always with research, of all the recommendations that you can make, which feel like the biggest priority, which would make the biggest difference to the most people in the study. So if you had to kind of think, look, you know, you've got one or two shots at reform, which would make the biggest difference from this research, which
Thanks
would they
for that
be?
Question, Karen.
Yeah. Always the hardest one.
If you were to put me on the spot, I think I
it's very hard particular in such. Sorry, Tigo.
No, you go ahead, Marsha, and then Rita can come back in.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, it's just a hard question because people have such different circumstances. So one thing will obviously help some people in their situation, not so much another family because they have different circumstances. But sorry, Kata. Yeah. But that's avoiding the question.
Yes, yeah, like asking which is your favourite child. Yes. As Marsha said, because everybody's circumstances are different, different aspects of the system, if it's not working properly, will affect different households in different ways. But if I had to pick one, I think I would probably say the interaction with other means tested support, because it's been really neglected. And whenever people talk about making work pay and doing assessments of universal credit compared with, say, tax credits, they nearly always only look at entitlement for universal credit. Rarely do they look at the knock-on effects in terms of other means tested support, mainly because it's so hard to do, because like I said, it all depends on the individual circumstances of the household, how they're impacted. But I think that would be the area that I would choose, because it just has been really neglected so far and nobody has looked at it. But if I could choose a second one, it would, I suppose, be employers, because you know, they can make a huge difference as well. And again, they've been very neglected so far. A lot of these other issues have been known about by DWP and they've kind of resisted like doing anything to change them. So maybe kind of pushing a different direction might get a better response, potentially.
Yes, there's something here about the sorts of reforms that you might make incrementally that might make a big difference are relatively easy to make, or areas which have been relatively underexplored, as you say, Rita, in terms of employers and their role, which may generate a dividend for the policy and claimants that just haven't been looked at as much, rather different to the sort of big ticket items on the taper rate and, you know, the work allowance and so on. So, but plenty there to examine. And I think one of the benefits of this research actually is that it has that very rich picture of how the system is working, and so you can take those sort of larger policy questions as well as some of the more kind of technical incremental issues that nonetheless this research throws up and shows to be important. We're coming to the end of our hour, so I want to thank everybody for joining this event today, for coming online and listening to the presentation of the research. We're very grateful to you for taking time to join us. The details of all the material that we're making available were put in the chat by our colleague Amy, and so go on the website, download the report, the executive summary, all of those sorts of things. Rita's written our blog as well. There's plenty of material for people to download if you're interested in further exploring the questions. And as Rita says, we will be doing further work, further briefing notes based on the research, looking at particular questions like childcare, self-employment and so on. So keep an eye out for those in the months ahead. Just to say then finally from me, a big thanks to Rita and to Marsha for presenting the research, for doing the research. It's great. It's great research and adds to our knowledge and understanding of universal credit in really important ways, I think. So thank you very much indeed for doing that today for us. And I'll just finally end by saying, you know, we have a lot of research on the welfare state in different dimensions at the IPR. So please do sign up to keep in touch with our work more generally if you're interested in social security reform of the welfare state and other things in the future. So that's it from me. Thanks for joining us. See you again soon. Thanks very much.
Thank you.